This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. A bit later in the hour, we're going to be talking about barbecue and how you can inject a little science into your grilling to help to perfect your technique. But first, what happens to the fish and marine life on a planet where global warming is heating up the oceans? Will fish and other marine life simply swim towards cool waters? Well, it might not be that easy, according to a paper published in the journal Science. Curtis Deutsch is one of the authors on that paper. He's also a professor of oceanography at the University of Washington in Seattle. And he joins us from KUOW in Seattle. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thanks, Ira. It's great to be here.
Tell us what happens in those warming oceans. Are the oceans get too warm for those fish and sea creatures to survive?
Yes, that's right. They can become too warm, and also they can become too poorly oxygenated. And so that was the question we started with, was, you know, how these things might combine to affect species habitat. But, you know, that's a question that sort of runs squarely through a much more fundamental question, which is, you know, why do plants and animals live in some places and not in others in the first place? Mm-hmm. And it's a very old question, because it's very easy to ask and very hard to answer. Probably a lot of your listeners will have asked themselves this question just by, you know, hiking to the top of a mountain and seeing that, you know, different kinds of trees live on different sides of the mountain or different parts of a valley. And so it's also hard to answer because there are so many factors that can influence that. And that's true on land and it's true in the ocean. The ocean is a much more difficult place to study this question because, you know, at first glance, you just look out over the vast expanse of water and it looks like there's really not much to see. But if you were to somehow take away all the water and leave all the living things suspended in it, you'd see tremendous pattern in the way that species are distributed across from the equator to the poles and from the surface down to the deep water and between different oceans. And so, you know, we're trying to explain how that kind of patchwork quilt of certain species can come about. And again, it's, you know, a very old question, so we only have a little bit of a new answer, but that's an exciting part of the study.
You found out that it's not as simple as the species moving north to find colder water, and that if I read your paper correctly, they're going to lose about 20% of their habitat by 2500 under the current trends in the ocean. So what happens to them? Where do they go?
Yeah, well, they will move toward water that tries to maintain an ability to support the energetic needs of the organisms. And the energetic needs of the organisms depend on a couple of things, and it's a fairly simple equation. It's that energy is sort of equal to food plus oxygen. Now, it turns out that in the ocean, oxygen can be a fairly scarce resource for animals, unlike on land. The ocean doesn't have nearly as much oxygen. And so for animals that need to breathe in water, oxygen can become too scarce. And at the same time, temperature influences the amount of oxygen that they need. And so if waters warm up, it turns out that most organisms, this is true on land and in the ocean, need more oxygen to breathe. But a peculiarity about seawater is that when waters are warmer, they also have less oxygen in them. And so we looked at a lot of physiological data that shows this pattern, that the warmer the water is, the higher the concentration of oxygen is needed to sustain the life of a wide variety of species.
So what's going to happen to them? You studied the Atlantic cod, the Atlantic rock crab, sea bream, and eel pout. Are they just going to die out by not being able to adjust?
Well, if they try to stay in the exact same location in the ocean, I think they would probably die out. And so the way to cope with that is to move toward water that either has a cooler temperature so that they need less oxygen, or toward water that is better oxygenated. And it turns out that those two things tend to go together, and they tend to push species toward more polar-type waters where waters are cooler and the oxygen is higher. So we think that a lot of the habitat loss will happen kind of on the warm edge of the range in which species currently live, and it'll push those species away from more warmer waters and in toward more cooler polar waters.
There was another paper in the Science that you did not work on, but I want to talk briefly about the corals, that the corals, in trying to move further north because they're looking for cooler water, because the sunlight is not as intense as you go norther, they tend to find shallower waters to their liking.
That's right. I mean, corals, corals are a very interesting case because they're animals, but they have these plant endosymbionts, things that they need to live with, and mm-hmm. the plants need light. And so unlike, say, the fish that we've described here, the corals can be confined toward very high light type situations, and that can prevent them from moving toward more polar mm-hmm. waters. And I think that's an interesting, additional constraint that corals will face that, perhaps fish won't. Mm-hmm. So, different types of marine organisms are going to be facing a wide range of different types of stresses in the ocean. And one of the challenges facing us as scientists is to figure out how those stresses combine together. Yeah. And our study was trying to do that for oxygen and temperature. And then, the corals have their own peculiar mm-hmm. Constraints that they face.
Well, Dr. Deutsch, thank you for filling us in on how to adjust to the new normal as we move ahead this century. Curtis Deutsch is one of the authors of a paper in Science. He's also professor of oceanography at University of Washington in Seattle.
Thanks, Ira.
Henry Gray, Gray's Anatomy, that big book, do you have it at home? He published his meticulous index of the body. That was over a century ago. And since that time, we have developed X-rays, we have MRIs, we have all sorts of technology that compare through your body, ultrasound. And even though we think we may have mapped out the entire corpus, it turns out that there is more to be discovered. A group of researchers studying the brains of mice found a group of previously undiscovered vessels, and the vessels might be a missing link, as they call it, between the brain and the immune system, something unknown before. The findings were published this week in the journal Nature. Jonathan Kipnis is co-author of the research. He's also director of the Center for Brain Immunology and Glia at the University of Virginia in Charlottesville. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thank you very much, Aaron.
Why have these things remained so undiscovered?
Yeah, well, we don't know. I guess we were lucky and they were waiting for us to be discovered. but we are among the few labs who are interested in this very unique area of the brain, the coverings of the brain, so-called the meninges. And we've been looking into this area for a few years now, trying to understand how immune system in those areas affects the brain. And about 5 years ago, published that immune cells in this area actually influence the way at least mice perform cognitive tasks. And so if we remove those cells from this area that are surrounding the brain, mice don't learn the cognitive tasks as well. So we were very interested to find the ways how these immune cells get in and how do they get out of this area of the covering of the brain, the so-called meninges. And I was lucky to have a phenomenal postdoctoral fellow in my lab, Dr. Antoine Louvoux, who developed a very unique technique of mounting this entire covering as a whole mount. And then I think this is what allowed us to find those vessels.
And what role do they serve?
Well, so the lymphatic vessels in the entire body are having two roles. One is they collect the interstitial fluids from the tissues with all the debris and so-called the junk or the damaged material from the tissue, and then they drain it out into the blood and into the close by lymph nodes. But they also travel, serve as a paths for immune cells trafficking. So the immune cells are taking up, the example I'm always giving is imagine a cut in your finger. So there is infection, and the immune cells take up this material, drive it to the local close by lymph node, and activate so-called soldiers of the immune system to then go back to the site of your finger cut to fight the infection. Mm-hmm. And this process continues until the infection is being killed or finally cleared. And we thought that these vessels do not exist in the brain.
Yeah.
And what we found is actually found those vessels in the brain.
So what are the implications for studying diseases of the brain, maybe Alzheimer's?
Yeah, so this is a great question. Alzheimer's is the disease where you have these big chunks of proteins which accumulate in the CNS. So we don't know yet. We haven't shown in our paper. We just described the basic biology of this vessel. So we haven't addressed their role in any particular neurological disorder. But these big chunks of proteins, so-called the amyloid plaques, they need to be removed from the brain. And most probably, they are removed through those lymphatic vessels. But we think there are so many neurological disorders now coming up. The immune link with so many neurological disorders is now obvious. For example, in autism, in Alzheimer's, in obviously in neuroinflammatory disorders like multiple sclerosis. So if immune system is involved in those disorders, the communication between the brain and the immune system is mediated by those vessels. So we believe that they probably will be playing major roles in most, if not all, neurological conditions where immune system is involved.
So you found this in the mouse. You just take it for granted that it's in humans too?
No, actually, we actually published the human data as well. It's our extended figure, supplemental figure 4. We actually provide a sample from a human brain. It's very hard to get good human samples. So it was hard for us. But now we're establishing some collaborations with clinicians and we're getting fresh samples. So I think we will be able to better describe them. But yeah, we did show there is something that looks like those vessels in humans. So we...
people were quoted as saying, you know, we have to rewrite the textbooks. Now, certainly the anatomy book.
Well, I think textbooks need to be fixed because if you open today a textbook, it says that CNS is an immune-privileged site and it has no lymphatic vessels. I think it is an immune-privileged site that has lymphatic vessels. So I definitely, should be revised.
So you think there's going to be a flood of research now into how to make best use of this discovery?
If I have one dream, this would be it.
Yeah, where would the money come from?
I guess from the listeners on the public. I think this is why it's so important to get public support for the research, and we're all funded by the NIH.
Well, we're very happy to talk about it because it is an exciting development, and we want to congratulate you.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
Curtis Deutsch, author of one of the authors on the paper that appeared in the journal Science. It's Jonathan Kipnis, one of the authors on the paper. Published in Science, Discovering the Vessels in the Brain. Thank you for taking time to be with us today.
Jonathan, thank you very much. Jonathan, thank you for the listeners.
You're welcome. Jonathan is Director of the Center for Brain Immunology and Glia at the University of Virginia in Charlottesville, Virginia. We're going to take a break. When we come back, we're going to talk about grilling tips, the science of barbecue. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. We are now heading into the meat of the barbecue season. And for all of you backyard pitmasters, what is your go-to cut? Maybe a nicely marbled brisket? If you're going to get fancy, maybe a nice porterhouse? Or the classic couple of burgers? What about chicken? Chicken can be tricky. I understand. It takes constant surveillance. My next guest is here to break down the science behind barbecue chicken, and he's going to answer your science grilling questions. Meathead Goldwyn runs the Amazing Ribs website. He joins us from WBEZ in Chicago. Welcome back to the program.
It's a pleasure to be back, Ira. It's always good talking to you.
You know, my mouth just starts watering when we start to you talk.
I have a dirty job.
Yeah, it's a tough one. Let me allow our listeners to get in. Our number is 844-724-8255, and you can also tweet us at SciFry. That number again, 844-724-SciTalk. Let's talk about this beer can chicken. It's one of the most popular ways to barbecue a chicken. You've done your own research on the method. How good is it?
Well, first of all, beer can chicken is a roast chicken, and there's nothing wrong with roast chicken. Everybody loves roast chicken. But a lot of people seem to think that there's something magical that happens when you stick a beer can up the butt of a chicken, and it just doesn't happen. That beer can is like a giant condom. The beer can't escape it. It can't get through the can into the walls of the meat, and there's so very little space at the top of the can. And what's even funnier is as the chicken cooks, the fat and the juices drip into the beer can, and it gets a layer of fat on top. But the most important concept of all is that the chicken comes out of the refrigerator at 38 degrees, and it's a cold, wet blanket wrapped around the beer can. So it's just like a chicken beer koozie. Your beer can is never going to get any hotter than the chicken. And if you cook the chicken properly, you cook it to safe temperature, 160, 165 degrees, that beer is never getting over 150, 160. It's just not going to boil.
Is there any way to do the beer better? I mean, instead of in the can, is it a worthy thing to try? Not the beer can chicken, but to add beer to your recipe.
Well, you could drink the beer and then take a bite of the chicken and take a drink of the beer and a bite of the chicken. Standing a chicken on its end makes a lot of sense because you do get convection airflow if you leave the cavity empty, and then the chicken heats from the inside. Now, you know, a lot of people don't understand that when you cook meat, whether it's indoors or outdoors or vegetables, it's the hot air that cooks the outside of the food. But the outside of the food is what cooks the inside of the food. The outside of the food is like a battery. It stores the energy and pushes it down into the center. The air doesn't get into the center of the meat. It's the energy from the hot air stored in the exterior of the meat that cooks the interior of the meat. So if you empty the cavity, then you have the ability to get hot air inside the meat. You cook it from both sides, and there's less drying out of the meat.
Mm-hmm. Now, when I grill chicken and I grill chicken parts, and I'm always wondering, I know that there's a bone in some of the parts of the chicken. I know that the bone conducts heat, and maybe it will cook that part of the chicken near the bone faster. Should I flip it over on the not bone side, or do I want to cook the bone side first, or just put it all under the hood and leave it there?
Yeah. You know, actually, it's interesting. The bone is also an insulator. It just heats at a different rate than the meat. Meat is about 75% water. The bone is a little less water. It's a drier compound. So at first, it's actually a insulator, and then as it warms up, it becomes a conductor. So it really changes its properties as you're cooking. The secret to good chicken is, and the secret to all good grilling, is set up your grill in two zones. One side is hot, the other side is not. Indirect convection heat on one side, direct radiant heat on the other side, and you start your food on the indirect side where it's not as hot. Gently warm it. You lose less moisture that way. It evenly cooks throughout, and then just the opposite of everything you've been told, you sear it at the end of the cook, and then you put all that energy on the surface, you crisp the surface, you brown the surface, and you take it off hot and crispy. And you don't have flare-ups that way either.
Oh, yeah.
You cook indirect.
Oh, yeah.
You get chicken
that
is notorious for
forest fire in the grill.
Oh,
yeah. go ahead.
Oh, I mean, you just
should
carbonize
you
a, your
should,
chicken.
Should you use a water bottle? You know, should you be ready if that happens and try to spray?
If you're using charcoal and it starts really flaring up, a water bottle will help. But you should not have flare-ups. If you use two zones, start on the indirect, and right, you cook by convection airflow that gently warms it, and you can throw some wood chunks on the charcoal, and that'll put smoke in the air. You'll never have a flare-up.
Here's a tweet from Annette who says, to brine or not to brine first?
Ah, salt is magical. Salt is different than any other spice and herb in the cabinet. It's a very small molecule, sodium chloride, and it splits when it gets wet. It gets electrical charges, and salt really penetrates deep into the center of the meat. Garlic's just not getting past the surface. Too big a molecule. Sugar, black pepper. But salt gets down in there, and so brining is a great technique because salt helps retain moisture, and it also adds flavor. It's an amplifier. It builds flavor. Now, there's two ways to go about brining. One is to get a big bucket of water and put salt in it and dunk it in there. But there's a really easier technique, and it works just as well, and that's what we call dry brining. And that is, an hour or two before you cook, sprinkle your meat with salt. What happens is the salt melts, and it moves into the chicken or the steak or whatever you're cooking. It migrates down into the food, and it does its little job of moisturizing and flavor building that way. And you don't need to get a big bucket and fill it with water and measure out the percentage of, rule of thumb, about a half a teaspoon of kosher salt per pound of meat.
I want to bring on somebody you might enjoy our next little segment. We're going to talk about chimps and cooking. And my next guest says that humans may not be the only ones who enjoy a nice cooked meal. It appears that chimps also like a cooked potato or two. They can't control fire to barbecue their meat or their bananas or whatever they have, but they do have the cognitive ability to prefer cooked meals over raw ones. And my next guest and her colleagues tested out this question, and the results are published in the journal Proceedings of the Royal Society B. Alexandra Rosati is an evolutionary biologist at Harvard University. Welcome to Science Friday.
Hi, thanks for having me.
How do we know that chimps really like to eat cooked food? What did your experiment show?
Well, actually, we did a whole set of experiments looking at a lot of different capacities for cooking. So, you know, the obvious thing that you think of when you think of cooking is controlling fire. But we were thinking about it that actually cooking involves a lot of really complex cognitive capacities. So at one end, you have things like preferring cooked food, because if you don't even like cooked food, why would you do this in the first place? But you also need things like patience, because cooking takes time, and self-control, because you have access to raw food when you start cooking, but you have to refrain from eating it in order to acquire the cooked food. So we did a series of experimental studies with chimps where we gave them the opportunity to place raw food in their own possession in a sort of magical artificial device that transformed it into cooked food.
And they preferred, from what I understand from this test, when given the choice, they would actually wait for you to cook them the food, then take the raw food that's sitting there right in front of them.
Yeah, so we found that, you know, at the most basic level, they had a strong preference for, in our test, cooked potatoes over raw potatoes. And some previous research had already found that chimps preferred a variety of foods better when cooked, so things like meat and mm-hmm. other tubers like potatoes and carrots. And so we tried to take it a couple of steps further. So, for example, we looked at whether they were willing to wait delays while food was being cooked, and also whether they would transport food, because you think often when humans are cooking, you find the raw food at one location, you know, in modern life at the grocery store, yeah. But in traditional societies when you're foraging, then you have to transport it, which is sort of an inhibitory control problem, because you could be snacking on it the whole time. And we found that in a variety of situations, chimps were willing to pay these costs in order to acquire the cooked food.
So they would bring the raw food across the room to you to so-called cook it for them.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it was a challenging problem for them because, you know, chimps are knuckle walkers, so they would very often try to carry the food actually in their mouth, and you would see them almost eat it on accident, right? You can imagine trying to carry some raw cookie dough in your mouth if you were walking over to your oven. You might take a bite now and then, and they definitely had problems completing these tasks, but they were able to do so at a pretty high rate.
Is there any evidence that, I should ask Jane Goodall this question or someone else, that chimps ever had cooked meals or cooked food out in, you know, the wild, where maybe there was a fire that happened? They discovered it?
Well, in wild chimps, there are some observations of wild chimps observing natural fires and even entering forests where bushfires have gone through and trying to eat some of the seeds or nuts that are left behind, suggesting that, you know, chimps can sort of calmly watch fires without totally freaking out, and they also seem to make some potential inferences about the utility of fire. And I think our studies add to that by really disentangling the exact cognitive processes that they're using to do these behaviors.
Now, we had the primatologist Richard Wrangham on, and he said that cooking had an effect on our evolution. Does this sort of tie in with that?
Yeah, actually, Richard Wrangham's cooking hypothesis was sort of the original inspiration for our studies, because Richard Wrangham proposed that cooking was this really fundamental shift in human evolution that occurred fairly early, earlier than other people necessarily agree that cooking sort of emerged. And we were thinking that actually these sorts of psychological tests with chimpanzees can provide another line of insight into this question. Because if chimpanzees are able to make these inferences, that's pretty good evidence that the last common ancestor of humans and other apes also could make these kinds of inferences.
Meathead Goldwyn, any reaction to all of this?
Well, I could be potato head myself. I could eat potatoes of all forms. And I've read Richard Wrangham's book, and it's brilliant in my mind. I just have to wonder if they were offered a banana at one or the other end of the process, if they're just not trading one food for another, and if they're cognizant of this raw potato being a different form of the cooked potato. Do they see that as they're both being potato?
Yeah, I think that's a great question. And actually, we had a couple of studies in our set of experiments trying to really look at exactly what you're saying. Like, do they just think that they're trading something for something better? And actually, what we found is that the chimps specifically tried to place raw food in these devices. So if we gave them food that had been pre-cooked, so you didn't need to place it in the device, then they refrained from doing so. And also, if we gave them inedible items, you might imagine that they think, oh, I could just put this piece of wood in the device and I'll get something tasty out of it. But we found that actually they were quite uninterested in trying to place inedible items in the device. So we think this suggests they have, you know, some basic comprehension of how this transformation is happening.
All right. Fascinating, Dr. Rosati. Thank you for taking the time to be with us today. Good luck in your further research.
Thank you.
Alexander Rosati is an evolutionary biologist at Harvard University. I'm Ira Flatow. This is Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International. Talking with Meathead Goldwyn, who is from Amazing Ribs, AmazingRibs.com. We're talking about barbecuing and how to become a better chef on the grill out there. And we're focusing on chicken, but we're willing to talk about other stuff on the grill. What is your favorite thing to grill, Meathead? Or is that a silly question?
No. I think... I really love a good lamb chop. A good thick lamb chop. I guess red meat is, but come August, I will go a week or longer without touching meat. I mean, the garden is in full bloom. I just cooked the other night eggplant parmesan by making a marinara sauce by grilling tomatoes, carrots, celery, onion, and garlic, putting them through the food processor. Unbelievable marinara sauce. Put the eggplant on the grill, spoon the marinara sauce on top, grated parmesan on top of that, and a little bit of mozzarella. Oh, my goodness. So, you know, summertime's here. Doesn't have to be meat every night.
Yeah, I'm partial to portobello mushrooms on the grill.
Oh, yeah. And I think if I lived on the coast, I'd be fish head.
Meathead. I want let's talk about pink meat not always being in raw. Where does the pink color come from?
Well, pink color comes from myoglobin. Myoglobin is a mixture of water and protein. A lot of people think when they cut into a steak that juice that runs out is blood, but it's not blood. It's this myoglobin fluid. Blood would be very dark red, almost black, just like yours when you cut, and it would coagulate instantly. So, I mean, I like to say every time we call it blood, somehow, a teenager becomes a vegan. we're just grossing people out. And that's why I think so many people want their food cooked to well done. They don't want to see the blood. But it's not blood. It's just myoglobin. And there's a big issue with chicken on this subject. You know, we grow chickens now so fast. They come to market in 6 to 8 weeks. The bones don't have a chance to calcify. The way we process them and handle them, you can cook it up to 165. And by the way, I'm going to jump off for a second here. The most important tool an indoor cook or an outdoor cook can own is a good digital thermometer. Meat is ready when the thermometer says so, not when the clock says so. 165 degrees is safe for chicken. Consumer Reports did some tests in their February issue. 97% of the 300 chicken breasts they tested had pathogenic bacteria in it, and half of those were antibiotic resistant. At 160 to 165 degrees, it's safe. Spend $25, get a digital thermometer, not an old-fashioned dial thermometer. They're not as accurate. And medium-rare steak is 130 degrees. You'll never overcook and waste money. You'll never undercook and get anybody sick.
Good. And about washing the chicken, what's the mythology
of
that?
There's some really good research on that, too. If you wash chicken, you put a spray in the air, invisible spray in the air. So you're standing there at your sink with your dish drain next to you and all your clean dishes there, and actually you can be spraying microbes up in the air as you wash it. The scientists say don't wash your chicken. I know it sounds weird and it may feel a little slimy, but as soon as the chicken hits the heat, anything that's on there is dead.
Yeah.
So they say don't wash it, otherwise you'll get pathogens all over your kitchen counter and all over your dish drain.
Yeah, all right. We're going to have to take a break, and we're going to take a break and come back and talk more about cooking, grilling, outdoors, chicken, other stuff we'll tackle. Our number, 844-724-8255. Talking with Meathead Goldwyn from AmazingRibs.com. Great website. It's the science of grilling this hour. You can also tweet us at SciFry. The number again, 844-724-8255, 844-SciTalk. I'm just getting hungry talking about it. We'll be back after this break. Stay with us. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. We're talking this hour about the science of barbecue and grilling. My guest is Meathead Goldwyn from AmazingRibs.com. Our number, 844-724-8255. There are a lot of folks who would like to talk to you, so let's go right to the phones. Let's go to Ted. Somebody's off the line there. Let's try this one. Let's go to David in Huntsville, North Carolina. Hi, Daniel.
Hi.
Hi there.
I had a question about beer can chicken. When you cook that, is the steam from the liquid what causes the chicken to be so tender, or does the alcohol from the beer actually have something to do with that?
Well, as I think I answered earlier, there is not much steam from the beer. It can't get hotter than the chicken, which is surrounding it. And boiling is around 190 to 200, 212. It starts to steam at 190, yeah. 200. It boils at 212. The chicken's done at 165. It does not steam. If you weigh the can before and after, in many cases, the can weighs more after because the fat drips into the can and the fat lays on top of the beer, so it doesn't work. It doesn't steam. Hmm. It doesn't get into the meat. And even if it did steam, where would the steam go? The can is in the way. It can't go through the can.
Yeah. Okay. Maybe someone just tuning in at that point.
Well, we did the first 10 minutes in about 30 seconds.
You got it all in there. Let's go. Tucson, hi. Welcome to Science Friday.
Hi.
Hi there.
I used to have a recipe from James Beard that called for boiling spare ribs in water with celery and carrots, you know, make a broth and boil it in there with spices for about 10 minutes, 15 minutes, and then letting it sit in a marinade of wine and, you know, barbecue sauce, you know, and then grilling it. And it always turned out great. But it's just tender and juicy, and I can't find that recipe. I looked for it on the internet. Maybe can you shed some light on that for me?
Well, James Beard wrote one of the very first books on grilling and barbecue, and I have it. So if you'll come to the website and drop me a note, I'll find you that recipe if it's in the book that I have. But just a thought for you about that subject. Water is a solvent. Water dissolves things. That's why you use it on your windshields. That's why you wash your hands with it. When you put meat in water, what happens? The water turns brown. You're making rib stew, rib juice, rib soup. So you're pulling flavor out of the meat. It makes a very flavorful meat, but you know, a low and slow dry cooking method, you're going to have more pork flavor. That's why a lot of the great barbecue restaurants in the world or roadside barbecue stands, they use a smoker and they keep the temperature down around 225. They put a great spice rub on the surface and then they hit it with a little barbecue sauce at the end. And all that flavor stays in the meat.
Mm. There's a phenomenon called the meat stall, right? It can be your brisket's worst nightmare. What is happening there? Describe what it is and what's happening.
Yeah, this is something that happens only to people who are deep into barbecue when they're making a long, low, and slow cook of a big slug of meat like a pork shoulder or a ham or a beef brisket. These are big chunks of meat. And you cook them at a low temperature because they have a lot of connective tissue. And if you cook them at a low temperature for a long time, well past well done, like up to 200 degrees in the meat, it melts those connective tissues and you get this succulent, gelatinous texture that only happens in low and slow. slow cooking. But what happens at that low temperature is moisture starts evaporating from the surface. And as it evaporates, it cools the meat. So you get this point, and especially newbies who are just getting started with smoking, where the meat hits a temperature around 150, 160, and it doesn't go up. And it sits there for hours, and they panic, and they send me emails. They find my phone number, and they go, what am I going to do? It's called the stall. It's an equilibrium where the meat is cooling by evaporation, and yet it's warming from the warm air. And you just got to ride it out. And what happens eventually is the surface dries out, and that's what makes the crust or the bark that we all love, the crunchy, concentrated flavor where your rub was. And so you just got to ride it out. You can beat the stall by wrapping the meat in aluminum foil, but a lot of us just have patience.
It'll go. It'll overcome itself. You just leave it.
Eventually, as the surface dries out, it stops evaporating water and it stops cooling, and the meat just starts chugging right on through and finishes cooking.
We've had a couple of callers calling in. I got three or four, so I'll just say it myself. What about cooking vegetables? I know your name is Meathead, but do you have any tips for grilling veggies?
I love grilling veggies, and I was talking earlier about how I made eggplant parmesan just the other day. The big difference between veggies and meat is veggies have a little higher water content. They run about 90%, let's say. Meat runs about 75%. That's shocking to a lot of people. Meat is 75% water. Vegetables, 80, 90% are water. Whereas meat has protein and fat, vegetables have more sugar and carbohydrates. But pretty much salt and pepper and some herbs are all you need. The same basic core concept. Two zones, a hot side and a not hot side. That way you can gently cook the food in the not hot side. And then when you want to get browning, which is a chemical reaction called the Maillard reaction or caramelization, which is when sugar changes, you can move it over to the hot side and get those browning flavors. And so you can control your temperature moving back and forth from the not so hot to the hot side. And, oh, goodness, you know, start with corn on the cob, everybody's favorite, zucchini, eggplant parm, as I said, roasted peppers, stuffed peppers. August around our house is cooking off the garden time.
Mm-hmm. So there's no need to put the stuff in your oven first and then finish it on the grill.
No, a grill is an oven. Mm-hmm. It's just a different kind of oven. The biggest difference between a grill and your oven is the thermometer on your grill. It's a piece of garbage. I don't care how much you spent for it. And it's up there in the dome, and your food is down there on the grate. So it's telling you what the temperature of the dome is, which does you no good unless you plan to eat the dome. You want a temperature of the meat. Again, thermometers. Forgive me for preaching thermometers.
No. We're science. We measure things. We understand that.
Measure things, exactly. Yeah.
So where should you put the thermometer? Should you get a stand-up one that sits on the grill itself?
The best thermometers are these new digital. This is 2015, isn't it? Yeah.
Let me look.
We got the 2015. We got digital thermometers. You can get a probe and you can lay it right next to the meat so the probe is feeling exactly what the meat is feeling. Now, you don't want it too close to the meat because there's a cold air bubble around the meat. You want it a couple of inches away from the meat, but right at the level on the cooking surface. You can also put a probe into the meat and watch the meat as it cooks. And then, of course, the best thing is the instant read thermometer. $25 for a thermometer that gives you a reading in 5 seconds, $100 for one that gives you a reading in 2 seconds. And you can stick it anywhere in the meat and know exactly what the temperature is. And there's no guesswork.
And you would say that's the most important thing to know about grilling is getting that thermometer.
Yes.
If you had one tip to give to somebody.
Get a good digital thermometer.
What about that?
I bought $10,000 worth of thermometers last year and gave them to an electrical engineer and bought some equipment for him to bench test them. And we have all that test results on the website.
Let's get to one last call from Alicia in Pennsylvania. Hi.
Hi. First of all, I promise I will buy a thermometer that is digital. I promise.
I love you, Alicia.
Second of all, how did you clean the grill? I have a gas grill, and it has these two, the grill tops where you cook the meat. The instruction said that I should just, you know, put the heat high for 5 minutes after I'm done cooking, and then that's clean. But all the ashes stay on the grill. Do I clean those ashes? Do I leave them? What do I do?
That's carbonized meat protein and fat that sits on there, or in the case of vegetables, carbohydrates and other things. And they just carbonize, they burn. So you need to get a brush. You can actually take a handful of wadded up aluminum foil and just scrape it across there, and it works pretty well. But it doesn't get underneath, and that's where grease builds up, and you want to get the grease off. So the best thing is to get a brush, and you want one that's very sturdy where the bristles are stuck in there really well. Cheap brushes, the bristles can fall out, and every year we read these cases of people who ate a hamburger, swallowed a brass bristle from a grill brush, and had to be rushed to the hospital. Not a great way to spend 4th of July.
Well.
So a wire brush or a wad of aluminum foil. There's a variety of cleaning devices. At the risk of promoting my website, we have ratings and reviews of all the cleaning devices. But yeah, fire it up, burn it to a carbonized black, and then scrape it down.
Well, Meathead, thank you for taking time to be with us. Meathead Goldwyn.
Oh, always fun.
AmazingRibs.com. What do you wish people? May all of your what be what when you say barbecuing to somebody. I don't know.
Cooking for others is an act of love. And the most important thing is not what's on the plate, but who's in the chairs.
And there you have it. We could not have a better ending. Meathead Goldwyn from the website AmazingRibs.com. Have a great barbecuing weekend. Thanks for taking time to be with us today. Next up, parthenogenesis. You know what that term is? That term kind of has the ring of Greek mythology to it, doesn't it? And that seems appropriate because what it describes almost seems like the stuff of myth when it comes to vertebrates. It's a form of asexual reproduction. And while asexual reproduction has been witnessed in birds and reptiles in captivity, scientists studying the sawfish population in southern Florida got a shock when they examined the DNA of some of the fish. About 3% of the population was the result of asexual reproduction. The results were published in Current Biology this week. Joining me now is the paper's lead author and PhD candidate at Stony Brook University, Andrew Fields. Welcome to Science Friday.
Hi, Ira. Thank you for having me.
Why did the fish have to reproduce asexually?
Well, that's a good question, and we're still looking into it, but it looks like it could be due to low population levels.
Hmm. And so no one had seen this in the wild. We had seen it in captivity.
We have seen it in captivity, and there have been a couple cases when they found parthenogenic offspring in the uterus of a snake, but never a live, free-swimming vertebrate.
How does it actually happen? What's the mechanics of asexual reproduction?
Well, during the process of creating an egg, there are three other cells created. So the egg itself has one set of chromosomes, and each one of these extra cells also has a set of chromosomes, and we think that one of those small side cells fuses with the egg itself and becomes an embryo and develops and becomes a pup in the end.
In case you're just joining us, we're talking about asexual reproduction, parthenogenesis in fish, sawfish in Florida, talking with Andrew Fields on Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International. Is it a big deal about the sawfish? You know, that for you saw it on a sawfish, or that it's a vertebrate, or that the wild thing in captivity is the biggest deal?
Well, it is a big deal for sawfish. Their populations right now are at very low numbers, and so it would be great if we could increase their numbers. Unfortunately, this process also reduces their genetic diversity, so it's a negative for the long term.
Did the sawfish look any different? I mean, how did you know that they had reproduced asexually?
So, yes, the sawfish themselves didn't look any different when they were caught. But once we started looking at their DNA, we saw a distinct difference between these and all of the other individuals we were looking at.
Mm-hmm. So these new sawfish that reproduced asexually, are they structurally the same? Will they have trouble reproducing either sexually or asexually?
That's something else that we don't know the answer to. So since we didn't know that they were from parthenogenesis when we caught them, we didn't analyze them in any particular way, but they had the same size and looks of all the others of normal sawfish. So we'll have to wait until they mature, which could be a long time, since sawfish are born at about 2 feet long, but they don't mature until they're about 10 feet long.
Wow, 10 feet long.
Yeah.
Does this mean that people are going to rethink other fish, too, that they might reproduce asexually?
Well, we have seen that a number of shark species have produced parthenogenic offspring in captivity. And so it may not be that this is all that unusual in the vertebrate kingdom, but it could be that when populations get to low densities, we see this kind of event.
What was your reaction and the reaction of your colleagues when you deciphered that this asexuality reproduction was happening?
Well, we were pretty shocked. I mean, we didn't expect to see parthenogenesis. We were just looking at the population to monitor their diversity, and this is kind of came out of that work.
So were you looking for it, or did you stumble on it by accident?
It was a complete accident. So we are monitoring the small-toothed sawfish down in southern Florida because they are endangered, and we want to check their diversity levels to make sure that they're not decreasing. But it just happened that we found these.
Ah, so what's your next step?
Well, our next question is this specific to sawfish, or is this common in reptiles, fish, and birds, and we just don't normally see it because normally they're at large enough population levels that they do find mates, and in this case, they're not finding mates.
Hmm. So you have a lot of work to do.
Oh, definitely.
Yeah. Well, thank you for taking time to be with us today.
Well, thank you very much.
So, you're welcome. I'd like to thank my guest, Andrew Fields. He's a PhD candidate in the Marine and Atmospheric Science Department at Stony Brook University. That's about all the time we have for today. If you download today's podcast, we have a bonus. We have a bonus interview for you. It's our Science Diction series. Science historian Howard Markell talks about the origin of the word sun. We talked a lot about sun in our science club, Sun. And Howard Markell, a bonus podcast for you. BJ Lederman composed our theme music. Our thanks to our production partners at the studios of the City University of New York. And if you go to our website, not only can you download our bonus podcast, you know that iconic photograph of a milk drop splashing to form a shape of a crown? Well, it's our picture of the week. And you can read the backstory at sciencefriday.com/milkdrop. Interesting stuff for you to do this weekend. And of course, you can always listen to every part of our program all week long. If you like us, go to our Facebook page and like us on Facebook. Have a great weekend. Hope you're going to do some barbecuing. I'm Ira Flatow in New York.